Machiavelli said it is much safer to be feared than loved, and that we should just try to avoid being hated, if anything. Does this align with your rules of power or not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My first rule of power is getting out of your own way. And one of the ways in which people get in their own way is that they are overly concerned about what everybody else is thinking about them. They're overly concerned with not offending anybody, you know, and you look at the Elon Musk, I don't think Elon is concerned at all about offending people. I don't think Donald Trump is concerned at all about offending people. So I'm not sure when he was Prime Minister, Boris Johnson was concerned about offending anybody. So this idea that you have to be, you know, that your job is to optimize how many people love you is, I think, wrong. When you are put into a position in an organization, when you're put into a leadership role, your job is to get stuff done. And, you know, when people, not everybody's going to like what you're doing, not everybody's going to like how you're doing it, get over it.
Definitely. And I feel like I've spoken to a lot of people my age, and they might want to start their own social media channel or their own business. And, you know, you have to use power to be successful at that. But what I found is that they come up with all these elaborate plans and reasons why they can't do it. And what's the reason for these limiting beliefs? Why do we care so much about what people think when, like you said, the most successful people right now clearly don't?
I think power raised. I think it's what our religions teach us. But it's also, I think, as you go to school, you know, at least when I went to school, which is, of course, a long time ago, when I went to school, you know, you got graded on deportment. You got graded on getting along well with others. I'm trying to picture a Larry Ellison score on getting along well with Oracle, getting along well with others. So I think very early on, you're socialized. School and many jobs socialize you to fit in, follow the rules, do what I tell you, you know, and so it's natural for people to want to get accepted and to be praised. And so they try to, you know, fit in and follow the rules and not stand out too much and et cetera. And I think this is particularly true for some cultures. I just did a podcast with a friend of mine, Dave, who is Asian American. And he said, certainly in the Asian cultures, you're taught absolutely keep your head down, do hard work, and don't stand out. And there are all these sayings, you know, in Australia, they talk about the tall poppy syndrome.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And in Japan, they say the nail that stands out gets hammered down. I'm trying to think of Rupert Murdoch and how he fit into the tall poppy syndrome.
Yeah. Well, he's quite a tall poppy. He didn't get cut down.
Yeah. Or for that matter, somebody who probably people don't know quite as well, but another media figure in Australia, Kerry Packer. There's a fabulous book entitled The Rise and Rise of Kerry Packer. Not The Rise and Fall, but The Rise and Rise. You know, so we're trained to fit in, and you know we like people to like us, and so we worry excessively about what everybody else is thinking about us, not recognizing the eternal and the fundamental truth that they're not actually thinking about us.
Exactly.
They're thinking about themselves.
Exactly.
Thinking about themselves. They don't care about you. They're not thinking about you.
Yeah, no, I constantly have to tell myself that and remind myself that. And what are some ways that we can reprogram or reframe our minds to continually remind ourselves? What are some strategies you found to help us stop caring about what people think?
So what I do in both my online class and in my on-campus class on power is we succeed to have people work with executive coaches. So the Stanford Business School has graciously furnished me 6 executive coaches who have now worked with the class for 7-8 years. The online class has what we call course facilitators. There are about 14 executive coaches who have coaching experience. And so what I tell people is that, you know, if you're going to do things that don't come naturally to you, you have to get social support. So get yourself some friends. Get yourself an executive coach, get people who will hold you accountable and help you overcome your barriers. So if I said to you, Jacob, I want you to become a professional tennis player. You would not say, okay, I'm going to go out, I'm going to hit the tennis ball, everything is going to be cool. You would probably say, I'm going to get myself a great coach. and I'm going to practice. So that's how you learn anything. Power, yeah. Tennis, golf, whatever, playing the piano. You get yourself a coach, you get yourself a teacher, and then you practice.
Yeah. I think it was Stephen King who said, imitation precedes creation. And is that what you're kind of referring to? We have to imitate these role models before we can become it ourselves. Is that the best way?
You have to imitate the role models, but also you need to get feedback. You need to get feedback in training. So, you know, if you're playing the piano or the French horn or whatever instrument you're playing, and you've got a music teacher, the music teacher is going to point out to you what you're doing well and what you aren't doing well. They're going to give you tips to how to do what you're not doing well a little bit better, and you're going to practice. And so, you know, practice and coaching is what makes you good at anything. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, in my classes, I say, you know, you want to be as good a tennis player as Venus and Serena Williams? I got bad news for you. They started when they were 6 years old. You're no longer six. And by the way, they played a lot of tennis and got fabulous coaching. That's precisely how they became. I mean, they obviously have natural ability, and not everybody's going to be as good as they are. But even with natural ability, it requires practice and coaching.
And can that coaching be virtually or online, or do you recommend more in person for this?
It can be absolutely online. And people say to me, it's interesting, because I had this conversation the other day with somebody. They said, you know, coaching is too expensive. I said, give me a break. You know, coaching is an investment that you make in yourself and your career. And the payoff, if we can, you know, if you're young and your career gets accelerated even by 5 or 10%, over time that compounds.
Yeah.
So how can you not, how can you tell me you're willing, you know, to drive a Tesla and spend, you know, a fortune on this car that basically falls apart? You know, you can tell me. You tell me you're going to buy, you know, Bruno Cucinelli jackets, and you won't spend money on coaching. You will invest in your appearance, but you won't invest in yourself. And I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah. And is, do you think a reason why people do have these limiting beliefs is because they stop education at the age of 18 or 21, and instead they should be continually investing in educating themselves throughout their entire life? Like, you should never stop learning, right?
Absolutely. Continuous learning is absolutely key. I have a friend named Gary Loveman who ran Caesars, the big casino company. And then he worked at Aetna, and now he's got a startup. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think has made him successful, and one of the things that's made most of the successful CEOs I know successful, is that they are intellectually curious. So if you're intellectually curious, if you're interested in learning, if you're interested in asking questions, particularly today with the internet and the resources, you can find the answers. But if you don't ask questions, you're never going to find any answers, because you will have never asked the questions in the first place. So I think intellectual curiosity is a really, really important quality to develop, to look at things and to say, you know, how is it that Donald Trump actually won the election? How is it that he can get away with doing what he's doing? How can, you know, why is it that we now have, you know, Viktor Orban in Hungary, you know, and how could it be that Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the son of the Marcoses, who apparently looted the Philippines, at least by allegation, you know, how could he be elected into the Philippines? And you know, I taught a class. There was a guy from the Philippines there, dean of a business school in the Philippines. And he said, well, you know, people remember the Marcoses fondly. I said, don't give me that. I said, the Philippines is a country of young people. Ferdinand Marcos was put into power by people essentially not much older than you, Jacob. I mean, you know, he was voted by people who were born long after the Marcoses had fled the country. So, you know, when you ask questions about what is going on and why, you can learn. If you don't ask the questions, you'll never learn anything.
And you've said before that everyone is a bit irrational in the sense that they think the world is fair and just. And when I've been studying history's remembered people, the eminent dead, they don't seem like necessarily the nicest people in the world. How come we're punished for, or we're apparently punished or told not to do, you know, not to, I guess, you know, maybe do some quote unquote unethical things, but then the best or most remembered people do those exact things that we get told not to do, and how do they get away with it?
Well, I think, first of all, people will say these people are exceptions. And, you know, you can't learn from these rare cases. I don't think that's actually true, because I think everybody who's successful does a little of this to some extent. The people who are very successful go to an extreme. And the desire to believe that the world is a fair and just place is a manifestation of our desire for control. Mm-hmm. That, you know, if I can learn the rules, I can play by the rules. If I learn the rules and play by the rules, I will succeed. And this gives me some control over my fate. If I say the world isn't a fair and just place, then I feel like I'm less in control of my life. Well, I will tell you, if you learn the 7 rules of power, the title of my most recent book, and you use it, you'll do just fine. But but people, you know, and people don't want to do things that make them uncomfortable. And, you know, and it's easier. And I think you said it perfectly. People make excuses for why they can't do what they want to do. You know, to take an easy manifestation of this, people know that they have to eat healthier and give up not have so much salt and not drink so much alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, they always find excuses or they put it off. I'll go on a diet next year or after my New Year's resolution. I'll do it later. I can't do it. I can't, people find excuses for not doing what they know they need to do. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why you need a coach or you need a personal board of directors or you need somebody to hold you accountable. So if you say, I'm going to do X, Y, or Z, somebody actually will then in a week or two say, by the way, Jacob, you said you were going to do this. Did you actually do something? You know, you said you were going to go out and meet, you're going to make a list of 10 people who would be important for your career and you were going to figure out how to meet them. Did you actually do that? Did you go out and meet 10 people? So one of the things we try to do in the classes is actually our executive coaches is to have people do these assignments in which they say, I'm going to, for instance, meet 10 people or 20 and then hold them accountable. Did you do it?
Mm. So powerful. It's so easy to fail in private when you don't tell anyone something. Like you could, if you tell your mind, okay, I'm going to do this diet I'm going to wait till New Year's, you know, that's fine. You can forget about that. But if you tell your entire social circle, your mom, your best friend, your partner, oh, I'm going to do this diet, I'm going to smash it out. And then you don't, there's way more punishment there, isn't there? And is that what leads to the motivation?
That's exactly correct. And also they will encourage you. I mean, one of the things that coaches do is not only hold you accountable, but they encourage you. They say, look, you did this and you got this great result. And so one of the reasons, you know, I'm not that charming. One of the reasons why my class is so popular is that it transforms people in 10 weeks.
Hmm.
And we transform people by giving them, number one, the tools and the ideas and the social science theory, and then have them do things. We force them, you know, we force them to build a personal brand statement. We force them to have a doing power project. We force them figure out who they need to be in contact with and go network with those people. We force them to think about what the personal qualities are that they need to develop and how are they going to develop them. So we try to not only give them knowledge, but force them to turn that knowledge into action.
Mm. And do you have any super successful specific examples of that with specific students?
Thousands. So I just did a masterclass, which you may or may not have seen, but in any event, the masterclass is called The Power Playbook. The founder of Masterclass, David Rogier, is a former student of mine, and he loved the class so much that he called me earlier this year, late spring, and said, would you do a masterclass on power? And so when I went down to Los Angeles to do this, because that's where they film for 2 days, I had dinner with him the second night. He was out of town the first night. Second night, I had dinner with him. And we talked about what he learned from the class and how impactful the class was. And he said, I use the material from that class every day. It's how I built Masterclass into a company that is today worth, I don't know, somewhere north of $1 billion. Wow. So, you know.
Do you get a percentage of that $1
billion? Yeah, unfortunately not. No. And one of my favorite examples, is Omid Kordestani, a name that no one would have heard of. Omid Kordestani came to the GSB in his View from the Top series and gave a talk. And somebody asked him what was his most impactful class. And he said, Jeffrey's class on power. So I reached out to him. I said, Omid, let's get together. I want to hear how my class was so important to you. And he said, I'm Persian origin. I'm a Persian immigrant. I had the immigrant mentality, went to engineering school. And now I have the engineering and the immigrant mentality together, which is basically work hard and everything will be fine. He said, I graduated from Stanford. I went to Hewlett Packard. Then I went to a couple of startups that didn't do very well. Anyway, in 1996, I found myself at Netscape. And I'm, doing business development and marketing. And my career is going nowhere. So one day I decided to take your class and take it to an extreme. And I said, what did you do? He said, I stopped doing my job. He said, I literally stopped doing my job. He said, instead of doing this marketing and these, biz dev reports and these analyses and things, he said, I spent all my time schmoozing, talking, networking, building social relationships with, first of all, the senior executives at Netscape. And then Netscape wasn't that big a company, the old browser company. He said, I, drove to the Silicon Valley and, talk to people about, the internet was just getting going. What's the future of the internet going to be and what's going to happen? And, is Netscape going to get crushed by Microsoft, which of course they did, And so I spent all my time basically networking. And he said, so in 1998, there was a little tiny company with about 10 guys, all engineers, of course. This is Silicon Valley. We don't think we need any marketing or sales. We only need engineers. They said they decided to hire their first business person, but this is a very analytically oriented company. And they decided that the way they were going to hire their first business oriented, technically oriented business person was they were going to ask every human being that they knew who was the best technically oriented business person that they could think of. And he said, so they went out and they got, they talked to executive recruiters, they talked to everybody they knew. And of course, there was one name, they got lots of different names, but one name was on every list, and that was Omid. And so Omid Kordestani became employee number 11 in a little company called Google.
Wow.
He made $2.5 billion. Wow. So,
that's incredible. And was that all because of the amount of networking he was doing?
Of course. That's because Google, he was on everybody's list. Everybody knew him. Nobody, Jacob, I'm sure you are intelligent and charming and many other things, but nobody is going to hire you if they don't know of your existence. Hmm. And knowing of your existence is necessary. It's obviously not sufficient. I also have to believe you're smart and can do the job that I'm hiring you for, et cetera, et cetera. But if people don't know about you, there's no way they're going to hire you. Everybody knew about Omid. And so he got the interview at Google and, Google, of course, interviews you like 1,000 times because they want to make sure they've hired the right person. And on the last time, the interview started at 4:00. At 5:00, he said, I know you guys are getting hungry. Let me take you out to dinner. He took them out to dinner, bought them dinner. Now Omid is smart. Omid is personable. Omid is handsome. Omid is, has a Stanford MBA and an engineering degree. I mean, he did not do this all on networking. But he would not have gotten a job if everybody hadn't done.
Mm-hmm. And for the young people out there who may have a bit of social anxiety or don't know how to network, what are some actionable behaviors that people should do right now to increase their network and get to know more people?
Well, you should make a list of who's the most important people that if you knew them, they could help your career. And then you need to figure out how to meet them, and then you need to reach out. And networking is basically about generosity. Networking is about helping people connect with other people that they need to know. Networking is about helping people. We do these, Stanford does these study trips. And so we had had this student from Columbia, the country, not the university. And she was, she was a co-organizer of the study trip to South America. And so she comes to my office one day and she says, I'm organizing this trip to Colombia and other countries in South America. I said, and how are you doing it? Well, she said, I'm calling all these CEOs and talking to their assistants. And I looked at her, I said, what do you plan to do when you graduate? She said, I actually plan to go back to Colombia. I said, so you are organizing a trip to Columbia for Stanford, taking all these students down there. And when you call these companies, you're talking to the assistants. I said, stop talking to the assistants, talk to the CEOs. And she looked at me and she said, I can't do it. And I said, of course you can do it. I said, do you have a call scheduled? She said, actually, I have a call scheduled tomorrow. And tomorrow was before the next time we met in class. I said, I'm going to help you do it because on the next class, I'm going to call on you. And I'm going to say, what happened when you talked to the CEO? And if you told me I didn't have the guts to talk to the CEO, we're going to embarrass you in front of all your classes. So the next class comes. I call on her. And she tells, of course, the story pretty much as I've just told it to you. And she said, I call. And when somebody said, you know, let me connect you on the phone to whoever the guy was, his assistant, she said, no, I want to talk to him. This is Stanford. We're organizing this trip. The trip has, you know, got these 20 or 30 MBAs. It's very important that I talk to him. She said, I talked to him. She said, the conversation went well. At the end of the conversation, he offered me a job.
Wow.
She said, I was transformed. But you have to, you know, again, if you're exercising, what does a personal trainer do? A personal trainer pushes you to lift the weights that you didn't think you could lift. To do the extra push-ups or pull-ups or whatever the exercise is. So you need people, not necessarily a coach, maybe not necessarily a trainer, maybe your friends, maybe whatever, whoever it is, to push you to go beyond what you thought you could do. Because that's how we get better.
Mm. Yeah, it's so easy to not push yourself when it's just you. But then again, the accountability, when you have the personal trainer or the training buddy, yeah, you're going to lift stronger weights. And once you have the power, you've networked relentlessly, you've got the job, you've moved up in the hierarchy. How do you use your power? Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
Well, that depends upon what you want to do with it. Some people use their power. I mean, so Machiavelli, who you quoted at the very beginning of this, said actually two useful things. One, he said, you need to be loved and feared, but if you have to pick one, be feared.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing he said, which I think people sometimes overlook, is that your first responsibility when you're in a position is to make sure that you keep it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody has a boss. Even if you're the CEO, you've got a board of directors. Everybody has a boss, and you need to keep your boss happy. You need to worry about what the boss thinks about you. You need to make sure that that you have a good relationship with the boss. And so your first responsibility, once you have power, is to make sure that you keep the power. So Stanford Business School's motto is change lives, change organizations, change the world. And so what I say to my classes, you're going to change nothing if you're not in a position of power. So as soon as you lose the position of power, your ability to make all the wonderful changes, you know, fix climate, fix whatever you're going to try to fix, it's gone because you have no leverage.
Hmm.
It is, you know, there's a picture, I think, of a caricature, a picture of somebody with a long stick, and then you've got the fulcrum, and they're trying to lift the world. And, you know, and that is, of course, and you know, I mean, that's what leverage does. Leverage permits you to lift more than you thought you could. And so you need leverage, social leverage permits you to do more than you thought you could. So if you want to actually fix the world, you change lives, change organizations, change the world, you need leverage.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you have to have a position that gives you leverage.
Mm. Is that all forms of leverage? So media, money, labor?
Absolutely.
Social?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Mm. Okay. And you've also said as one of your rules, understand that once you've acquired the power, what you did to get it will be forgiven or forgotten. Why is this important and how is this the case?
Because people, I think, are oftentimes extremely reluctant to do some of the things that they know they need to do and that other people have done because they're, you know, nervous or something. Anyway, and so I, you know, once you have power, it all will be forgiven or forgotten, you know. And so your first job is to get yourself into a position of power. And don't worry, you know, people say, well, you know, they'll remember what I did to get there. They'll think I was too self-promoting or self-aggrandizing or I stepped on people. You know, it's interesting. Once you're there, it will all be forgotten.
Mm. Yeah. And are there any examples?
By the way, you can see this clearly in the case of Donald Trump. Yeah. Many of the Never Trumpers are now, you know, his biggest fans.
Mm. Yeah, and using Trump as an example, what are some obvious or maybe less obvious tactics that he's used to get his way into this such a powerful position over the decades that you've seen?
Well, I think number one, he does not have any self-limiting beliefs. Many people would say, I've never run political office at all. I'm not going to start at the top by running for the presidency. I'm going to work my way up. You know, the normal thing, you know, run for the school board or maybe the House or the Senate or whatever. So I think he is very much a rule breaker, which is my second rule of power, break the rules. You know, he ran an unconventional campaign. You know, many people say, you know, his campaign was disorganized. Apparently it was. He, you know, one of the things, when he ran against Hillary Clinton, I believe this is a true figure. I would not want to be quoted on this. But I believe somebody said that of the $1 billion that she raised and spent, she spent 3% on social media. And Trump, of course, was completely different than that. He's all about social media. And so, you know, I think he understands the current media ecosystem. And also he understands the aphorism that I've heard publicists say, which is that there's good publicity, there's bad publicity, but worst of all, there's no publicity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he basically was always in the news by doing outrageous things. And all of that media coverage, people estimate, was worth billions of dollars.
Mm. Is that billions of dollars just from doing outrageous things? Not necessarily.
Yeah, by getting all this media coverage. So he's on the media every night. He's on the media every day.
Mm. And for the people that want to gain power, but not necessarily be Donald Trump, how can they learn from him?
Hildy? Wait a second. Okay. Anyway, I'm in his house. We have just moved. We moved 2 weeks ago. The house is still kind of semi under construction. So I have workers outside in the yard, and then I have my, then we have the son of the contractor who also works for the contractor coming in to do God knows what.
Anyway, no worries.
It's part of the life here, whatever. It's one of the reasons when you asked me how I was doing, I said, I'm surviving. Every day is a new adventure.
Yeah. And what I was saying is, what can we learn from Donald Trump, even if we don't necessarily want all the power that he's got?
I think you can learn the importance of rule breaking. I think you can learn the importance of asking, of trying. You know, you don't get what you don't ask for.
Mm.
You know, if you want to go out with somebody, you probably need to ask them out. They're probably a pretty bad mind reader. if you want a job, you probably have to apply for it. Or you may have to apply for it. It's very hard to get what you do not, you know, what you do not seek. So I think the first thing, you know, I used to think that my class was successful because I taught people all of these social psychology, social science theories. I now think that the single biggest effect of my class is to make people bolder and more ambitious. Because if you don't set big goals, you're not going to achieve big things.
Yeah.
If you don't try, you're not going to succeed.
Mm. And how can you cultivate that self-belief? I've noticed that the more I do, the more I realize I can do. And I think proof is very important for getting self-belief.
Absolutely.
If you don't have that proof when you're just starting out, what are some tips for being, you know, confident?
Look around you. Look at the people who are succeeding. They're not better than you. They're just you. They're just a bolder version of you. Become a bolder version of yourself. Become more, you know. And, you know, what's the worst that can happen? You can try. You can fail. You know, many successful people have tried and failed. And, you know, I think persistence and resilience is important.
Yeah.
Because not everything you do is going to work. Not every product the company is going to launch is going to be a success. People forget, you know, that Apple, in addition to the Mac, launched a computer called the Lisa. You know, yeah. The people forget that some of the most successful drugs are repurposed from what their original intent was. I still remember Genentech, which is now, of course, part of Roche, an amazing biopharmaceutical company. Their 1 year, their CEO stood up in front of everybody and said, you know, congratulations, we've had a great year. Almost everything we did succeeded. He said, that's terrible. Because that means we're not pushing the frontiers of science. If you are pushing the frontiers of science, not every damn drug you put into development is going to succeed. If you are really, you know, if you're pushing, you know, people say to me all the time, Elon Musk's rocket, you know, blew up, fine. You know, if you're going to send a rocket into space, you're going to have some failures along the way. You're going to have to see what works, what doesn't work. You're going to have to learn from your failures. And so you have to just keep at it.
Does this relate to bureaucracy and why startups are often on the edge of innovation? Because if a company's a bit too bloated or a bit too old, they're more conservative and less risk averse. Is that something you've noticed?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And how do you avoid becoming, if you're a CEO of a company and it's past the startup phase, how do you become less or avoid bureaucracy and avoid becoming too bloated and keep being on the frontier?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Everybody claims they want innovation, but of course they don't, because with innovation comes failure. And when you take risks, not every risk is going to succeed. You know, not every stock you invest in is going to be a winner. Not every startup. I mean, the VC model is, I think, a way. You know, I have a colleague who says all companies should think like VCs, in the sense that a VC says, you know, I'm going to invest in a bunch of companies. Most of them will fail. One will be an outrageous success. And you can have that mindset inside a regular organization. You can say, look, I'm going to try a bunch of stuff. A lot of it won't work, but I'm going to learn from everything I do. This idea of being intellectually curious and have a reflective mindset. I'm going to learn from everything I do. And some of the things we do are going to work out amazing.
So you need to get, and you use the right phrase.
You talked about risk aversion. I think people are risk averse.
And so is it better to take small risks often?
Yeah, absolutely.
What are some examples of that in an individual's day-to-day who may not be in a startup or a company?
So my friend David Kelly has founded IDEO Product Development, probably one of the most successful product development companies in the world, said, you know, our motto at IDEO is fail early and fail often, which is much better than failing once and failing at the end and failing. So it is the idea of prototyping. Now, if I said to you, Jacob, you're going to launch a product, you would, of course, or some piece of software, whatever, you would, of course, prototype it. You would put it out into the world. You would get feedback from your users. And you would keep iterating. You ought to think of your career in the same way, that your career is a prototype and that you're going to iterate. You're going to tell you, and not everything you're going to do is going to work, but you're going to learn from everything you do. And over time, you're going to get better and better and your career will, in fact, accelerate. So if you think of your career as a prototype as well, I mean, if you're young, who cares if you fail?
Yeah.
You have lots of time to do other things. Nobody's going to remember. Nobody's going to care. So, you know, try stuff and learn from what you try.
Should you still be trying to fail when you're older, or is it better to try and just fail as much as possible when you're younger? And then
you should fail when the stakes are lower.
Yeah.
When you're in a position where the failure isn't going to, you know, do anything. If you're learning to fly an airplane, you need to fail in the simulator, not in the plane.
Yeah, true. True. And what's one surprising fact about power that most people don't know?
I'm not actually sure what's the most surprising fact. I think probably the thing that people get the most wrong is in fact Rule 7. They think that what they do is going to carry with them. That if they have been, you know, mean or stabbed somebody in the back, or if they have been too ambitious or self-promoting, or if they've been too aggressive or whatever the word is, that is going to be held against them and that people are going to remember. But, you know, how many people remember that Bill Gates stole the code on which Microsoft was originally built? The answer is almost no one.
Yeah. And do you have any examples in your career where you've done things that relate to what you just said?
Well, I didn't do this intentionally, but my doctoral dissertation, which became a foundation in organization science and has more than 40,000 citations, was something that I think, you know, people at the time didn't quite appreciate or understand, you know. So, you know, when I went out on the job market, I was turned down by all the best places. And 7 years later, I was a full professor at Stanford. So, you know, it's sometimes it works out. It doesn't always work out. But, you know, I still remember talking to a guy from the University of Chicago who said, we're turning you down. I think this is probably a mistake. He said, you have two choices. You can do what everybody in the field thinks you should do, or you can follow your own path. I said, I actually don't have a choice. I'd have to follow my own path. I couldn't, you know. So you have to do what you think is right. And again, you know, I mean, you look at somebody like Steve Jobs, he had a sense that the design mattered and that therefore he was going to obsess over what the iPhone looked like, what the Mac looked like, what the case looked like, the colors, you know, at a time when every personal computer looked the same. Almost all great businesses have become great and successful by doing something that nobody thought they should do or could do. I mean, NVIDIA, which is today worth $4 trillion, began as a company making gaming chips. So, you know, I don't think anybody saw how those chips were going to be as valuable as they are and how they could be whatever. So, you know, I think if you look at successful businesses, they basically have found their own path. They found the essential truth.
I listened to one of your talks and you said about how a lot of your contemporaries or a lot of graduates go down the beaten path and go where the competition's high. And you were saying you should do the complete opposite. Is this what you're kind of referring to, where you should try and find a niche that's overlooked by other people? And how, if that's the case, how can you do that? Where do you look to find
I think how you do it is, number one, not paying attention to what everybody else is doing. So what everybody else is doing is probably a sign that you shouldn't do it, unless somehow you're going to do it better than everybody
else. Yeah. Yeah.
And you see this, by the way, in professional sports, at least in American football. The most successful teams find their own way of running offensive schemes, find their own way of doing defenses. They're always innovating to try to find an edge on the competition, because they know if you just do what the competition does, you've put yourself in a place where it's going to be more difficult to succeed.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And what are some common pitfalls of powerful people?
They forget that they have a boss. That is the single biggest problem. They forget that once they're in positions of power, regardless of how powerful they think they are, they have to keep doing what got them there in the first place.
So do people become too comfortable, do you think?
Correct. They become overconfident. They become too comfortable. They stop doing what got them there.
And if you're in that situation, how do you realize that that's happening before it's too late?
You know, so the Wall Street Journal runs this thing mostly on the weekend where they talk, they ask people who is on their personal board of directors. So I actually tell people you ought to have a personal board of directors, three people or four people who are not competitive with you, not in the same industry, not in the same whatever, but who are smart and who will do what a board of directors does, which is give you advice and hold you accountable and tell you when you're going off the rails. So if you, if you think about what a board does for a CEO, a board says to the CEO, why are you doing this? They ask them questions and they say, you know, have you considered this and have you considered that? Because nobody is smart enough to have perfect peripheral vision. And so the way you get better peripheral vision is to have other people help you see things that you can't see.
Yes. And it's like when you give someone relationship advice, you know, it's so easy to give other people advice, but then it's actually much harder for you to take it yourself, right?
Yeah. And that's why you want to have people that you trust and like and that whose advice you will actually listen to.
Definitely.
Because if you're not going to listen to the advice, there's no point getting it in the first place.
100%. And why is it better to be confident rather than authentic?
Confidence. Cameron Anderson, the professor at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, has done a bunch of studies that shows that confidence is confused with competence. If you act as if you're confident, people will assume that you actually know what you're doing. And that is true even in some of the studies he runs. He actually gives people evidence that says, you know, these people are behaving confidently, actually don't know what they're talking about, but it doesn't matter. Confidence is confused with competence, and we all want to be perceived as competent. And nobody will be perceived as competent if you act like you don't know what you're doing, if you don't act as if you're certain that whatever you're trying is going to succeed. And again, you see this in startups, but it's not just true in the startup mentality. You know, I have a friend who co-founded Ning with Mark Andreessen. And she said to me, I said to her one day, I said, you must, and now she's founded a thing called Mighty Networks. I said, you must, as a startup founder, you know, there are days in which you don't know what you're doing, there are days in which you're not sure the company is going to survive, but you can't come in. She said, that's exactly right. If you come in and say, by the way, you know, we've had this setback, which happens to every company, and, you know, and I don't know how we're going to get out of this. She said, your customers are going to leave, the employees are going to leave, the investors are going to leave, and you're going to fail. So you have to act. You have to act as if success is assured, even if you're not certain that it is.
So it's actually more effective to fake it until we make it.
Absolutely.
Wow. And again, how come we're...
Amy Cuddy, the famous person who wrote this book called Presence and who has this fabulous TED Talk, says it's not fake it until you make it. It's fake it until you become it.
Yes. Belief before ability. You know, you have to believe it before you can become it, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, if you're going to become a concert pianist or going to become a professional golfer or whatever, you have to believe that it's possible against all odds, or otherwise you won't even begin. You won't even try.
Definitely. And before we start recording this, we were talking about how my generation tends to think that the world suddenly changed, but you were saying that you don't think it has. Could you elaborate on that? And are there more effective ways to gain power now than when you first started researching and delving into this topic?
I think the young generation, wants to be, to use a word that you've already used, authentic. I think the young generation, for the most part, wants to be able to be who they are and do whatever they want to do and hope that somehow their talent and charm will cause them to succeed. They don't have to go out and, you know, network if they don't feel comfortable networking. They don't have to, they are extraordinarily concerned about what everybody thinks about them because of the social media. Do you really want to be dinged on social media, whatever. By the way, some people are dinged on social media and recover. At the end, it's, you know, whatever. So I think the young generation is, because of the economy, particularly now, I think they're risk averse.
And how?
It does not serve them well. You know, I mean, what I tell people is, you know, if you go to a business school and you take a class in finance, you learn there's a trade-off between risk and return. The bigger the return, the bigger the risk that you have to take. And I think that's true in people's careers as well. If you just follow the rules and keep your head down, you will probably not get fired, but you probably are not also going to become CEO.
Yeah, definitely. And does seduction play a role in gaining power?
What do you mean?
In the sense that trying to persuade people to get your own gain from doing that. So not maybe necessarily in the relationship, well, romantic.
I think you have to be able, I think one of the underappreciated skills is sales. We are selling all the time. You're selling your ideas. You're selling yourself. You're selling your vision for what the company should do or what the organization should do. We're all in the sales business. It's interesting to me, most business schools do not teach a class in sales.
Yeah.
I am going to take my friend David Rogier of Masterclass, and I'm going to have him come to my class and talk not about the current version of Masterclass, where he's got, you know, Anna Wintour and Gordon Ramsay and all these famous people signed up. But at the beginning of Masterclass, there were no famous people signed up. And I want him to tell the story of how he got the first. How he got the first. Now it's easy. Now it's Masterclass. You know, we got this long list of people. Everybody wants to be part of that roster. In the beginning, he had nobody. He had a vision. He had a vision for what he was going to do. He had not done it. He had not, you know, in the beginning, of course, when you start the organization, he had produced exactly zero Masterclasses. He had told exactly zero. How do you get the first celebrity to sign up? And I do not know the answer to this, but he's going to come to the class and talk to my class about the beginning. The end is easy. I mean, once you're successful, everybody wants to be part of that success. It's the beginning that's hard.
Mm. And do you know how long it took him to make Masterclass successful, roughly?
It did not take very long at all, because Masterclass has been reasonably successful for quite a while, and it's only 10 years old, so...
Mm. And we have touched on social media, but how do some of your laws apply to social media? And does social media make these rules easier?
I think they, I'm not sure they make them easier or harder, but I think you need to be active on social media. You need to worry about your brand. You need to worry about what you stand for. You need to post about, you know, I try to post about issues of substance to me. I post mostly about power and healthcare in the U.S. because healthcare in the U.S. is a catastrophe. And I'm, you know, trying to fix it. That's the book I'm working on now. But in any event, you know, so I don't post things about, you know, I don't post pictures of my marble-filled bathroom or any of this other stuff. I try not to post about stuff that's, you know, about my life. I try to post about ideas because I want to be, my brand is about ideas. You know, my brand is not about, you know, the house I live in or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think you need to figure out what you want to be known for, and that's what you need to post about.
Yeah. Very good advice. And I've heard you say the most useful social ties are often the weak ties rather than your close friends. Why is that the case?
Well, that's because your close friends tend to know the same things and the same people you do. That's why they're your close friends, because they're similar to you. Similar people are useless because they know the same things and the same people that you do. You need to insert yourself into new social circles, and you need to learn things that you don't already know. And the way you're going to learn things that you don't already know is probably by interacting with people who are different from you, who have a different background, who have a different job, who are doing different things, who come from a different country, who travel in a different social circle. That's the only way you're going to expand. I still remember when we were in the old building before we moved to the new GSB campus. Every Monday morning, three women would come into class. They all sat together. And I began the class by asking them what they had done that weekend. And of course, after a while, it became a joke. And they would say, you know, of course, we spent the weekend hanging out with our friends. What else would we do? You know, we worked hard all week. You would spend the weekend hanging out with your friends. And I would ask them the question, if you always hang out with your friends, how are you going to make new friends?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's so important to escape your echo chamber. And maybe that's a problem with social media, is if you have these beliefs, especially Twitter or X, for example, if you like a post about one belief, you tend to get more posts about that belief appear in your feed, in your homepage. And that just leads to this echo chamber and a lot of confirmation bias. But I think I've learned best and improved myself best when I've had this cognitive dissonance where a previous belief I've held has been destroyed by someone else, even if I disagreed with them. And then I realized over time, I slowly implemented what their belief was, and that led me to improve myself. So how do we connect with people that we may disagree with? Is it genuinely just going out into the world and talking to more people?
That's exactly correct. Now, the poor Democratic Party in the United States has got all kinds of trouble. And so some of the more successful Democrats, I think, have done exactly that. The guy who's may win the mayor's race in New York, who came out of nowhere by going and talking to people and listening to them and taking their concerns seriously. I think one of the reasons why the Democrats have lost a couple of presidential elections, including Trump in 2016 and now Trump in 2024, is because I think people did not think that they were being heard. And being heard is important. So I have a friend, Amir Dan Rubin. Amir Dan Rubin ran Stanford Healthcare. When he took over, he was hired to run One Medical, which is a chain of primary care clinics in the United States. He sold One Medical to Amazon for close to $4 billion. He made a lot of money. He's now running a VC firm. When he came to One Medical, doctors today are burnt out. They've got the electronic health record, mostly Epic, which is, of course, a piece of crap. They've got demands. They've got all kinds of things. And he came to them. He went to the doctors. He said, look, he said, I'm hiring 100 software engineers because we have to be compatible with Epic. We do not have to use Epic. We're going to build our own software. We're going to build software that is custom tailored to you. We're going to send software engineers to follow you around and figure out what tools can they give you that will make your work easier. We're going to custom design the tools for you. By the way, this is not going to happen in 15 seconds. And so, but he got a lot of credit for the effort. He got a lot of credit for the intention. He got a lot of credit for saying, okay, we're not going to get from here to London in 5 minutes, but this is the journey we're on. We're going to involve you in this journey. And, you know, the big problem in medicine is turnover. Doctors are leaving the profession, at least in the U.S., I suspect in the U.K. as well. Doctors are leaving the profession. Doctors are leaving the organizations for which they work. And he, of course, cut turnover way down because the doctor said, here is somebody who listens to us and who is trying to make our job easier and more effective, and he's going to invest in us. And, you know, I think that was one of the reasons why One Medical grew so much under his leadership. I think it's one of the reasons why he will be a successful VC, because he listens to people.
And what is so important about listening to people? Is it just making them
feel
important?
You learn. Well, first of all, they feel important, but secondly, they feel heard. And you learn stuff. You know, I mean, you know, nobody knows everything. If I want to know how to make your work easier and better, I need to go listen to you. I need to figure out, you know. So one of the things I don't do a lot of, you know, I'm a poor Stanford professor, but, you know, when I invest in startups, which I do occasionally, one of the things I look for in the startup founder is somebody who has a lot of on-the-ground knowledge about what they're trying to do. So I invested in an organization that's building a technology for the, in quotes, creator economy. They're creators themselves. I invested in a tax startup that's using AI to help people, tax professionals, do their work better and answer questions more quickly. This is somebody who began this business by struggling with his own tax issues. So, you know, I try to find people who've done something that's rooted in their own experience.
Mm. Yeah, it's very, very important. And What's one thing you want the viewers to take from this podcast episode?
That the biggest barrier to being successful is yourself. That rule one is that rule one is rule one of seven rules of power for a reason. That getting out of your own way is the first thing that you have to do. And if you cannot get out of your own way, you're not going to be able to network. You're not be able to build a personal brand that's effective. You're not going to be able, you know, to do. You're not going to be able to show up with confidence. You're not going to be able, or confidence, pardon me. You're not going to be able to do all these things unless you are. Everybody worries about the competition. Start with yourself.
Definitely. Because your, you know, insecure self is your biggest enemy at this point.
That's correct.
And if you had one piece of advice for 20-year-old Jeffrey, what would it be and why?
I'm not sure what my advice would be for 20-year-old Jeffrey. My advice for 32-year-old Jeffrey, which is the age at which I became a full professor at Stanford, is that, you know, I should have set some additional goals. I should have been bolder, probably. You can never, you know, become more ambitious. Do more.
Very good advice. Jeffrey Pfeffer, ladies and gentlemen, Jeffrey, really, really appreciate this. Thank you for enlightening myself and the audience on the rules of power and how to use it. And yeah, I just completely, it's just refreshing hearing someone say about the limiting beliefs, getting over it. You're your own enemy, because it's something I struggled with and the audience definitely have struggled with and probably continue to. So what are you currently working on now, and where can people go if they want to find more of your work?
Well, I'm online, apparently on YouTube, and they could take Masterclass. Masterclass is relatively cheap. You know, I have books, Seven Rules of Power. They can read the books. They can, and also I would suggest to them, and some people send me emails, you know, the list of the coaches that I work with in my class. It's one of the reasons why the coaches work with my class. I help them build their coaching practice, you know. So I would say, you know, invest in yourself.
Very, very good advice. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on the show, and really excited to see more of your books. That one on the healthcare sounds really interesting.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Jacob. It's been a pleasure getting to know you. You've done a great job interviewing me, and let me know when the episode goes live.
For sure. I will do. Awesome. If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show, but you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally, because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Promo Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast, because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.